The MMQB podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football. With more winners and more payouts than any other site, enter promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com to play a risk-free tournament at up to $10. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets.
Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I'm Robert Klimko. That was Andy Benoit. We are excited to have you for the 12th week of the NFL season. We have so many good games and a full Thanksgiving slate. We want to get to all the games we can. So we'll preview five of the our favorite Week 12 games, and then at the end of the podcast, discuss the Thanksgiving game. So if you only care about Thursday, stick around. First, we're going to get to some news and notes, a few key matchups from Week 12. The Browns host the Ravens Monday night, but the news surrounding each team seems more relevant than their matchup. Johnny Manziel has been named third stringer for the remainder of the year behind Josh McCown and free agent Austin Davis, undrafted free agent, excuse me. Do you believe, in the wake of these new videos and new evidence of Johnny partying during his bye week, several months removed from rehab, several weeks removed from the incident with his girlfriend and the police, do you believe that he's played his last games as a Brown?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Obviously, I mean, they said he's played his last games this season as a Brown. I would imagine yes, because if they are benching him now, for one, keep in mind, Manziel's played okay when he's been in there. I thought his game against Pittsburgh a few weeks ago was the best game of his NFL career by a wide margin. So he's on the uptick on the field, and yet they give him a quick hook for something he wasn't arrested or even accused of anything. He just had photographs of him partying on the bye week. My guess is he's not the first young player in the league or any player in the league to party on his bye week. So if that's what gave them the instigation to go and remove Manziel, then there are probably other things going on behind the scenes that we don't know about that have bothered this coaching staff, which to me would suggest that, yes, that's going to carry into next year and he won't be here.
You know, I don't even think that's necessarily true. You're downplaying it, but we're talking about a guy who went to rehab for a substance problem. So we're to presume that he has some sort of substance abuse deal, whether it's alcoholism or drug abuse, and he has been told by this organization that he can't go out and party under any circumstances. And not only does he go out and drink, but he allows himself to be photographed. He poses for photographs. It's almost as if he's trying to get cut by this football team.
But my question to that is, why didn't they do this when he had the incident with his girlfriend? Because in that instance, he told police he'd had two drinks during the day. So if presumably it's an all or nothing thing, meaning you're not drinking anything, Johnny. And if he admits to that and the NFL investigated and they had all that stuff, why didn't the Browns feel the need to bench him then if they're that concerned about his well-being from a substance abuse standpoint?
I can't tell you why guys get second chances, but you can't rule out the possibility that this one incident here was the last straw, and there's nothing deeper than that on Mike Pettine's mind other than the fact that they told him to do something and over again he refuses to comply.
You know what stood out to me, by the way, of Manziel's, of all his off-field stuff this season, the one that really jumps out at me is the reports that before the fight with the girlfriend, he was driving at a reckless speed on the shoulder of the freeway. We've all been driving and had some asshole come up behind us and be way too aggressive. And you wonder, who are the kind of people that do that?
Johnny Manziel.
Johnny Manziel, the kind of person. You know, I mean, it's one of those subtle things, but it's a real indicator of character flaw. I'm serious, Clem. Are you not?
No, I definitely I could see that. Of all the indicators, that's a good one.
I mean, we've all sped, but to speed on the shoulder like that and be going, double the speed limit or whatever it was, you know what I'm talking about. There's two kinds of speeding. There's the lack of attention, inattentive speeding. There's the reckless speeding.
Yeah, and also, presumably there's traffic, so he's getting a jump on everybody else. It's just, it's a jerk move.
Yes, exactly. It's a jerk move.
The other quarterback in this game is Matt Schaub, and this is an issue that you and I have talked about at length, but I just want to say it one more time. I'm tired of seeing guys like Matt Schaub in the game. Why are we seeing guys on their last leg at the end of their career being plugged into backup quarterback positions instead of 28 and under guys who either have had a starting opportunity and failed or had no starting opportunity, and seeing what these guys have to offer? I just don't understand why Matt Schaub, Matt Castle, and I'm blanking on some other names, but why these guys are still on rosters.
Josh McCown, Brandon Whedon. Well, you must really be passionate about it, because you totally buried the lead that Joe Flacco tore his knee up. And to me, that's the biggest story of week 11. Even though the Ravens are out of it, you wonder about Flacco moving forward. But you're already fired up about Matt Schaub being in there.
Yeah, I just don't like it. I mean, the guy, he had a great career. He's been dealing with an arm injury that has kind of slowed his fastball down considerably. The Ravens are in a lost season, right? So the least that they could do is find out if some 23 or 24-year-old has what it takes. Why isn't that guy already on the roster? Why do you have to go pick up Jimmy Clausen as your number three or now number two?
Well, so let's put it this way, though. Let's think about it. There's two things that strike me, and this first one does not apply to Baltimore because John Harbaugh's job is totally safe, and it probably will be for the next 3 years if they don't make the playoffs. He's been that good his first 5 or 6 years. But for most teams with quarterback issues, they have head coaching instability, and a coach, Mike Pettine's a good example. A coach is coaching for his job, so he is responsible, or his human nature for him to think, who gives us the best chance to win immediately? That's part A. Part B, you've got other guys you have to develop on the roster too, not just quarterbacks. And if you put a QB in there who's not prepared and callow and unready to function in the full scope of the offense, then how do you develop the players around him? And how do you get everybody else to buy in and play hard if you know that they're the most important guy on the field's not necessarily there for meritocratic reasons?
Here's the thing. It's not as though they've gone with this old win-now backup for all of Joe Flacco's career. I mean, Tyrod Taylor was there for 3 or 4 years, and clearly they developed him some kind of way because he's been a strong player in Buffalo when he's not injured. So
right, but the other problem, though, is it costs money to have quarterbacks, and all they did was wind up developing him for the Bills. They gave the Bills free quarterback development there because they can't afford to pay Flacco and Tyrod Taylor.
That's fine. Start with another young guy, and then if you get caught in that off year where the guy's a rookie or a second-year player and he's completely ineffective, I think that's a risk teams should be willing to take.
I don't disagree with you. Everything's easier said than done, of course, but I think this is a classic easier said than done scenario. I don't disagree with the general premise, but you've got other guys you have to develop, though. You got to keep that in mind.
Yeah. You make a good point. Let's move on to some of these game matchups. Biggest game of the week, in my mind, Patriots at Broncos. The Patriots are 10-0, Broncos 8-2. This is the Sunday night game. Brock Osweiler's first career start last week, a victory. He goes 20 for 27, 250 yards and 2 touchdowns, a 74% completion rate, 127.1 QB rating. Not that that means anything. A couple things stood out to me, Andy. They're able to get the running game going, and they're using two tight end sets a lot.
Yes.
I think both Vernon Davis and Owen Daniels were on the field more than 65% of the snaps in the game. I'm actually going to talk to Owen Daniels this week a little bit about that for my Friday game plan column. You had a note on the Broncos film. You said Osweiler has very little juice in his arm. He's a ball pusher. His rope throws loose energy on back end. Very descriptive, by the way. I like that.
But thank you. Yeah.
Could you just explain that to all the people who fired back on Twitter that you have no idea what you're talking about?
Oh, okay. Well, ball pusher. So that speaks to throwing motion. And does the ball snap out of his hand and come out with energy, or does it take a lot more oomph that he has to manufacture behind it? Does he have to get his shoulder more involved than other guys? All that stuff slows down your release. Matt Schaub, we talked about, I can't believe it's in the podcast twice already, but he was a classic ball pusher for a lot of times.
Sure.
It's just, he's not a snap thrower. That's one. And then two is almost always with a ball pusher, a rope throw, just, you know, whatever you call it, shooting bullets or when the ball is thrown on a rope, when it zings in there, his ball will consistently lose energy or die or trail off just ever so slightly at the intermediate levels. You don't pay a price for that always. Sometimes you do. It really is. It's not so much a criticism of Osweiler. I know it sounds like it is. It's just stating what he is. That's the kind of passer he is. It doesn't mean you can't play with him, but you have to play with him accordingly. And against the Bears last week, the Broncos did a great job of that. You mentioned the two tight end sets. They did some really good stuff out of two tight end sets that defined the reads for Osweiler, didn't ask him to stick the ball into tight windows. That's been Denver's approach, obviously, because they've been playing with Peyton Manning all year.
I'm not going to argue with you on his velocity. I do think that the offense that they ran on Sunday is Kubiak's identity all the way. Under center, more than one tight end on the field. I think that they would like to see Peyton run that kind of offense, but there's been a lot of pushback. And I wouldn't be surprised if Osweiler plays well, despite being a ball pusher. If he plays well against the Patriots, maybe not even well enough to win, but just well, that they will have a mini quarterback controversy on their hands when Peyton is ready to come back.
They will, because that offense you're describing features outside zone running. And with outside zone, the more you can stretch on the handoffs, the more dimensional you are. And stretch handoffs, this sounds as simple as it gets, but the quarterback's got to get over and out to the offensive tackle to hand the ball off. He's got to run and move. Manning hasn't been able to do that for a few years, and so those stretch handoffs have gone away. That's why they've gone to more pistol stuff. You don't lose that element with Osweiler. We didn't see all of it against the Bears, but conceptually, I think they're going in that direction. I think we'll see more moving pockets, as you said, if Osweiler plays well. I'm still a proponent of putting your Hall of Fame quarterback back in the lineup when he's ready to go. But if Osweiler plays well, what you said is a mini QB controversy. Absolutely. They'd at least have the discussions buzzing around them.
Yeah. What a accomplishment it is by itself to just be able to play so long in the league that you can't complete a stretch handoff, and yet you're so you're so valuable that you're still on the field.
Well, yeah, that you're right. That is a compliment. It's other guys, too. I wonder if Brady could do the stretch handoff. I mean, when I'm talking stretch, you know, obviously they can do it once in a while. But remember when Manning early in his career and he had Edger and James, mm-hmm. he'd do that play action and it took a full 2 seconds to even see if there was a fake handoff or not.
It took a while.
It's always to the perimeter. That's what I mean with the stretch handoff game. Can you do that consistently, snap in and snap out? And I wonder if Brady could. It doesn't matter because they're not going to play that way, especially with LeGarrette Blount, but I wonder if he could.
Last week we wondered whether or not it would be Keyshawn Martin or Danny Amendola getting most of the snaps after Julian Edelman's foot injury. Danny Amendola received a team-high 29% of the Patriots' targets since Edelman went down. Were you surprised that it ended up being Danny?
No, I did think the week before I said I understand the logic of Martin and I could see why they would do that. Martin didn't play and Amendola did, and he looked very good in that capacity. So I get it. You know, Amendola's not Julian Edelman, but he was the next best thing for them. And so much of what they do with those option routes and those underneath throws is aided by the quick pace timing of the offense and by the mismatches that the formations create. So it doesn't matter who's at wide receiver some of the time, because they're almost always facing a linebacker who's rushed into the snap. And that's always a wide receiver versus a linebacker. Any receiver is going to look good in that matchup. Amendola was the guy they felt most comfortable with, and that makes sense.
Let's move on to Steelers at Seahawks. The Steelers 6-4. The Seahawks five and five, fighting for relevance in the NFC West. It seems to me that the Cardinals have all but pulled away. I mean, one or two more wins for those guys, and I don't think Seattle catches up. But they probably will get a wild card spot. This game will be big. We're still awaiting word on the extent of Marshawn Lynch's injury, but he is potentially out for the year pending sports hernia surgery. But we like Thomas Rawls, big power guy, kind of similar to Marshawn, currently the 13th leading rusher in the league with 604 yards. Him starting, you know, while it's different not seeing Marshawn out there, but he's been a big part of the offense all year.
He has. He's similar in that he runs very violently, almost reckless even, but you don't mind that so much when it's a young guy, and reckless running has done some good things for that guy that he's replacing, it looks like. So you let the runner be what he is. And I like Thomas Rawls. He's good size, better movement skills than you would guess, and he is a violent runner. And Klemko, you've done a lot with the Seahawks over the years. I actually told our boss, Peter King, you're going to write a biography for one of those guys one day. my guess would be Richard Sherman. I don't know that, though. But being around that team, who is this Thomas Rawls guy? Were they expecting anything of him prior to the season, or did they think they had an idea of what they had in him?
Well, you know, I remember from last year and the year before, there was actually a lot of hype around Kristen Michael, and there existed Kristen Michael truthers out there who thought one of Pete Carroll's bigger mistakes was letting him go. You didn't hear much about Thomas Rawls, and I don't think that people knew, and people around that organization may have, but I don't think that outsiders knew about the speed that he has to go along with that power. I mean, he's shown a little bit of breakaway ability, which is not something that many expected out of him. I don't think anybody in Seattle was as excited about Thomas Rawls as they were at one time about Kristen Michael.
Yeah, interesting. And they still have Fred Jackson in the lineup. And why that's important is he gives them a steady presence on third down. Usually when you hear about running backs, and we're talking in this case about an undrafted rookie, when you hear about them coming into the lineup, it's, well, can they pass protect when they need to? Can they understand all the formations, the full scope of the offense? If you've got a veteran third down back who's in there no matter who the starter is, that's Fred Jackson, then you can make it no matter who the starter is, and it's easier to plug Thomas Rawls in. So I think Fred Jackson's presence has probably given the coaching staff more comfort to have leeway with this undrafted rookie runner.
Before we get into our break, I wanted to talk a little bit about their matchup in this game, the Steelers. You know, we talk a lot about the Cowboys just in the NFL world and everything ailing them right now. They lose a quarterback, they lose a wide receiver for an extended period of time, and one of their best players on defense, Orlando Scandrick. And so that's been the biggest excuse made for, you know, their failures this season. But you look at the Pittsburgh Steelers, they lose Roethlisberger for a chunk of time, they lose Le'Veon Bell, and yet they're 6-4 right in the thick of things in this AFC North race. What's the big difference?
Yeah. Well, they also lost Pouncey, and they were without Martavis Bryant for a few games, and they were without Ryan Shazier for a few games. The biggest difference, they did a good job of scraping by when Roethlisberger was out. They just gutted out some victories, and that's exactly what they needed to do. The biggest difference overall with this team in the grander scheme, and always even in the smaller schemes, is how good Roethlisberger is at the pre-snap phase. He gets rid of the ball as quick as any QB in the league out of spread sets. He's as dangerous before the snap as any quarterback in the league. He doesn't audible a ton. He has just gotten so good at identifying defenses that every guy around him has full optimum chance to succeed because the ball's getting to him so quickly in space. I think Roethlisberger is the most improved quarterback in the NFL over the last 10 years, and people don't talk about that. He's the reason they win games.
Yeah, he's been pretty exciting to watch over the years. And I mean, my favorite Roethlisberger moments are always the ones where somebody's trying to pull him down by his jersey, and it's almost as if he can't feel it, and he dumps it off for 5 yards. It turns into 15.
Yeah, he can still do that too, even though he's gotten good at getting rid of the ball. He hasn't lost that part of his game either.
Before we get into the rest of these games, I want to tell you a little bit about one of our sponsors, FanDuel. You watch every weekend, you study games like Andy Benoit, and you memorize statistics. Now all the time you spend studying football can finally pay off with real cash. Daily fantasy sports has swept the nation, and our new deal lets you try it out for free. Go to FanDuel and use our code TheMMQB. Then make your deposit and enter your first tournament risk-free. That's any contest offered on FanDuel for up to $10. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, FanDuel will refund your account guaranteed. FanDuel is the best place to play 1 week fantasy football. Building a team is easy and fun. Just pick your players and stay under the salary cap. Entry fees start at just $1, so there's a league for everyone. They offer the NBA and NHL, so you can play fantasy sports for real cash any night of the week. FanDuel is not just for large tournaments. You can set up private leagues and play against your friends anytime, anywhere. To get started, go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code TheMMQB. And we've got three more weekend games for you before we get into this Thanksgiving slate. The first one, Rams at Bengals. The Rams are an interesting team. They're 4-6. They've got one of the probably top five defenses in the NFL. But your starting quarterback right now is Case Keenum, coming off the head injury. Cincinnati Bengals, 8-2. A little bit of shine taken off their undefeated start, but still really a strong team. Do you see Case Keenum and the Rams threatening this team at all?
Maybe, because when the way they play, they can keep the game artificially close by running the ball and eating up clock. There's always fewer snaps in a Rams game because of how much they run the ball. Is Keenum playing in this one? I wanted to get your thoughts on his head deal and how, you know, you're big into the social side of football or the outside the lines stuff. And I can't fathom how what happened with him and smacking the head on the turf didn't get investigated more.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, everybody who saw it live on television thought Case Keenum was jacked up. I mean, who's the backup quarterback? Nick Foles runs off and goes and gets his helmet and starts warming up, getting ready to go in. And then Keenum's wobbling around and they allow him to keep playing. It's embarrassing. And none of the coaches have really adequately explained themselves in the wake of that.
No, it seems like every week now it's just a new explanation from Jeff Fisher of how either they are not dirty or the opponent's actually just as dirty as they are. It's the Rams have been. Do you think that's a coincidence that everyone's starting to accuse the Rams? It's become the easy thing to do, I guess. Once one team does, it's like that Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this a few weeks ago, how riots begin. Once the first guy goes, then the cost for the next guy becomes less, and so it's easier for him to say it or do it, and so on and so forth. It's become easy to criticize the Rams for being dirty. Do you think they're dirty?
I do think they're dirty, and I don't think they're measurably or considerably dirtier than any other NFL team, but Jeff Fisher's teams have had this reputation for a decade, you know, going back to Tennessee and Cortland Finnegan. So I don't think that this is made up or you know sort of a follow the leader type deal. I think that somebody had the courage to say something, and now everybody else does. Shifting back to on the field, Todd Gurley has rushed for 200 yards and 3.2 yards per attempt in his last three games after starting the season with 566 yards in his first four starts. Do you see this as a trend or just a bump in the road for him?
A bump in the road. If you watch, you have to look at, I rarely look at runners' statistics. I do at the front of film to get a sense for how the game flowed, but you have to evaluate runners for how they run the football, not the numbers in the end, because there's so many factors that surround them that are out of their control. When you watch Gurley as just a pure runner of the ball, he is easily one of the three or four smoothest, most balanced, and therefore most explosive runners in the league. He's as good as anyone. There's such a subtlety to what he does, a subtleness to the way he plays the game. He's going to be very hard to defend for a lot of years. I'm not at all worried about Gurley.
Let's move on to Bills at Chiefs. After starting the season 1-5, Kansas City is now the sixth seed if the playoffs were to begin today. They're 5-5 right now. Obviously behind the Broncos, but with the Broncos quarterback situation in limbo, you could see them winning this division somehow. Every year, there is a team that starts out, 1-4, 1-5, whatever, and either makes the playoffs or comes close to making the playoffs. Why has it been the Chiefs this time, and did you see it coming at all?
Well, no, I didn't see it coming. I guess Jamal Charles must have been the problem then, right? Once he went out, they got good again. So maybe he was totally overrated.
Well, yeah. the one thing that they do have had visibly improve is the play of Eric Berry, who went through chemotherapy in the offseason, the lymphoma treatment, and it seems like he gets better and better every single week.
Yeah, he does. And of course, I'm kidding about Jamal Charles. Chikander Quest has been solid for them, but that defense is what's changed with Kansas City. And I wrote a few weeks ago, and I think just in my film notes, this will be a top three defense in the second half of the season, because you've got, for one, corners who are, let's look at the guys that have gotten better on this defense. You've got corners who can play man-to-man. Marcus Peters has improved as a rookie throughout the season. He'll continue to improve most likely. Sean Smith, who wasn't there early, got off to a bit of a slow start. He's been rolling. You have Barry, who you mentioned coming off the illness, and he has looked better each week because he has been better each week. So the whole secondary has improved steadily, and it's a talented guy's improving. Then you factor in they've got edge rushers on both sides, Tom Bahaly and Justin Houston, and they've got speed right up the middle of the defense with Abdullah and Derek Johnson. This is an extremely tough defense to play against. And if you mix speed in the middle with good cover guys and edge rushers, it also means you can do whatever blitz you can dream up. So Kansas City right now is probably the defense I would least want to play against.
And the Bills in a pretty precarious spot here. They just lost to New England. Tyrod Taylor injured in that game, and we talked about him being a backup in Baltimore. He's questionable for this one. We don't know if he'll go. The backup is EJ Manuel. I don't give them any hope against the Chiefs if it's EJ Manuel out there.
I'd hate to say that, but I'm probably with you on that, because EJ Manuel's game against Jacksonville was the worst game I've seen by a quarterback on film the last 2 or 3 years. It was, I like EJ Manuel, but he was the reason they lost that game, quite frankly. And if he's in there, there's reason to believe that basic offensive functions will not occur. And that's already a problem for the Bills, because it's not like they're lighting the world on fire with Tyrod Taylor. They've been fine, but they're very simple, and they're going to be a week-to-week proposition because of that. I think the key in this one, Robert, is going to be Buffalo's defense, because I don't see Buffalo getting many points against Kansas City. I mean, probably 13 or 14. So can the Bills' defense make some plays? And the problem there, it's a defense built on creating turnovers, and they're going against a quarterback who is ultra-conservative and doesn't turn the ball over.
The Bills 14th in points allowed, 17th in yards allowed, just the definition of being right in the middle, but they are among the best in the league at that turnover margin.
That's the key for them too, by the way. They're built to, I know Rex Ryan loves the stats of points and yards allowed because it looks good on his resume and that's important to him, but they're built on creating big plays. That's why they do the pressure stuff. That's why they play quarters coverage instead of man-to-man. So they have guys as safeties that can jump passing lanes. So you said, where do they rank on turnover differential?
Let's see. Yeah, they're 11th in the league in turnover differential. Surely not as high as Rex would like. And last game against New England didn't help. Let's move on to Bucks at Colts. I actually watched this game for the second time on film today in advance of a conversation with Jimbo Fisher this morning at 7:15 a.m. So,
About the Bucks and the Eagles game?
I'm sorry. The Bucks Eagles.
I saw game. Your tweet. I saw your video tweet, and that encouraged me to do video tweets today. That's how I knew.
There you go. So the Bucks are 5-5. They go to Indianapolis, who is also 5-5. With Jameis, if you go back and look at the two interception game 2 weeks ago against Dallas, these are balls that are popping off of people's hands. They're not bad throws. They're not awful decisions. They're just balls that are a little bit high for quarterbacks thrown over the middle. Take out those two interceptions. He hasn't thrown a pick since they lost to Carolina 5 or 6 weeks ago. I mean, he's been really impressive. 5 touchdowns in this last game. And the thing that really strikes me is that it's all 3-step drops, very few 5-step drops, absolutely no 7-step drops. And he's only watching and he's only looking at one half of the field. So he's diagnosing pre-snap which half of the field looks good for the route combination. And then he's looking at 2 options, the inside guy or the outside option, the boundary option. And he's making the right decisions and his receivers are getting open.
Dirk Cutter's a good designer of offense, and especially if you give him a pocket passing quarterback, because that's what Cutter's forte is. I disagree with you a little bit on Winston's picks against Dallas. I thought at least the second one, they were both by Jeff Heath, but at least the second one to Heath, I thought was Winston didn't diagnose the coverage well. The first one's kind of an inaccurate ball, too, but that's, you know, we're stabbing at the minutiae here because we're talking about a guy that came in with a turnover problem and has taken a full scope of an offense on his back, ran the whole offense, and has not turned the ball over. So you're exactly right. And turnovers stem from decisions in the pre-snap phase often and 3-step timing especially. And if he's making the throws off a 3-step drop successfully, it tells you he's also reading the defense comfortably before the snap.
It also doesn't hurt that Doug Martin is second in the NFL in rushing with 941 yards behind only Adrian Peterson. I wanted to get into the Colts a little bit. Matt Hasselbeck is still undefeated as a starter, whereas Andrew Luck has struggled all season long. Did the Colts, in your mind, change schematically in any way when they had 2 full weeks to prepare for him being under center?
Well, I don't know how much of it was the scheme and how much of it was how he executed the scheme. But what he did against Atlanta, the running backs and tight ends are a much bigger factor in the passing game now. The balls aren't being stretched out to the perimeter downfield. Wide receivers not as big of a deal in the offense. I mean, T.Y. Hilton, you forgot he was even on the field against Desmond Trufant last week. And Andre Johnson, I don't know if he caught a pass. So it's more of a between-the-numbers passing game. And I would be real interested to ask Rob Chudzinski how much of that's by design and how much of that is by Hasselbeck's style of play. And, of course, it's going to be a combination of both. But to defend Indianapolis now, you need to defend the middle of the field and make Hasselbeck beat you outside.
All right. What do you say we get into these Thanksgiving games that people are anxious to hear about?
Yeah, it works for me. Real quick, we're going to tell you about the SeatGeek app, though. You can find a great deal on the SeatGeek app. All tickets are pulled into it. It gathers tickets from various websites, almost like Cheap Tickets does for airlines, and shows you the best deal that's available. And when you use the promo code MMQB, you get a $20 rebate with no strings attached. So how it works, you download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free, takes less than a minute to download. You search for your event, find the great deal, enter MMQB promo code, and when you complete your purchase, that $20 check is mailed to your residence. SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers online. Best deals automatically available, and they have a deal score function showing you a color-coded map that gives you the best value for your bang for your buck on those tickets. SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. So download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter promo code MMQB. SeatGeek will send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. For the NFL, college football, or even the best concerts, SeatGeek app, our code MMQB.
Before we finish the show, I just wanted to take a moment to kind of thank our listeners for being a part of the podcast all year round. It's been really exciting for us, and we appreciate every minute you've chosen to spend with us on the run, in the car, maybe in the car this week when so many of you are traveling to see family all across the country. I know I'm leaving Chicago and spending time in Maryland and Pennsylvania with some of my family. After you do that, please let us know what you'd like to hear more of in the podcast. We're very receptive to suggestions. This thing is still in its infancy. You can tweet me at Robert Klemko, K-L-E-M-K-O. Andy is at Andy underscore Benoit. And use the hashtag MMQB podcast to make sure we see it. But I check all my mentions, even the mean ones, so you don't really have to worry about that. But from our podcast family to yours, have a great Thanksgiving. And we appreciate you listening.
What's your Thanksgiving viewing routine like on Thanksgiving Day?
Well, typically I've been at a game every year that I've covered the NFL. So this is the fourth year, and this is the first year that I don't have to be at a game.
Huh. That's what was it like before you went to games then? Because I assume what you're doing for Thanksgiving now is relatively the same as what you did growing up.
It's a little bit different. Well, so before I would go, like last year I covered the Lions. I forget even who they played, but
the Bears. They played the Bears.
Yeah.
The Bears came out hot in that game too. The Bears had wide receiver screens up the gazoo, I remember.
You are such a weirdo.
Well, I just that's how I mean Alshon Jeffrey was red hot that game early on and then didn't last.
All right. Anyway, we were in Detroit. And a buddy of mine who I'd gone to high school with, his family lives in Detroit, so he was out there. Hadn't talked to him in about 4 years, but I put on Facebook that I was, you know, at the Lions game, and he texted me, and he was like, hey, do you want to come over for dinner and get a plate? And I'd go and meet his whole family, and it was awesome. You know, they were so nice to me, so interested in my job and everything. So it typically works out. You know, people hate to hear that you're working or you're in some city on your own on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's very gracious of your friend. I've never had to leave for Thanksgiving. My family is the host family for all the families around. Like, you know, my dad and mom's side, they all live near us. And so we've always done the same thing each year and watch the parade, watch the games. the biggest battle is dealing with family members that don't understand the significance of the games and feel like it's important to talk and stand in front of the TV during the broadcast.
Yeah, I can imagine you going off to a back room to watch by yourself. On.
Well, what I've done, and the people who heard the podcast last year know this, I do it on DVR anyway. I can't watch live games. The commercials have just gotten way too over the top, too many of them. So I do it on DVR, and I watch the Lions game, and then when people start to leave, I put the Cowboys game on. But I hid the remote control last year because I had cousins wanting to turn the TV on and see the game, and I didn't want any spoilers. And my thinking was, on a scale of 1 to 10 for importance, to me, this game's about a 9.5. I mean, it's important to me. And to my cousins, there were about 3 of them, 2 of them in particular. Each of them, it's about a 2, maybe a 3. So you add all that up, and it's still less than 9. And so I thought, I'm going to hide the remote. I don't care if it ruins their thing. It's not going to ruin their Thanksgiving because it was never a big deal in their Thanksgiving. They can go figure out something else to do. I'm not going to have this wrecked.
Why wouldn't you just have the conversation with them that you just had with me and say, I want to watch the game?
Oh, that's not how it works with my cousins. It's an older brother kind of scenario. If you tell them that, they find it funny, and that all that does is solidify their interest in ruining the outcome for
you. Oh, they're older than you. I was imagining, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of them's older, and one of them's my same age. But okay. The older one is the brother of the one who's my same age, so it's essentially 2-on-1.
Yeah. All right, before we bore people to death with our little holiday stories,
yeah.
Let's jump into this Thanksgiving game. We've got Eagles at Lions. Obviously, not a huge game. The Lions struggling, the Eagles struggling harder. It's a tale of two defenses. The Eagles have allowed 5.4 yards per carry in their last 4 games. The Lions allowed only 3 offensive touchdowns, though, to the Packers and Raiders in the last 2 weeks. Do you see the Lions finishing this thing strong? Maybe 8-8.
Maybe it's that defense has played really well, especially in the back end coverage wise. And I'm still waiting for that Lions pass rush to come to full fruition. And with Jason Jones and Ziggy Ansah, and even Haloti Ngata in there, but also Devin Taylor, they've got a lot of size and length and athleticism, and it hasn't produced quite up to the level you would expect yet. If that changes, this will be a very good defense. As far as your thing about the Eagles allowing 5.4 yards a carry, that's almost irrelevant because Detroit's running game is so unimposing. I wouldn't even worry about that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the Eagles are doing that, by the way. Their defensive line, the 3-man D-line, is the best in the NFL. So I haven't seen their last bit of film. I guess Doug Martin inflated those numbers now that I think about it, didn't he? He had over 200 yards rushing against them.
Yeah. Just a quick note on that Detroit defense. That Detroit running game. I'm watching some Khalil Mack tape just because I like to catch up on him every once in a while. And I watched the Lions last week run stretch to his side and they were asking a tight end, I believe it was Pettigrew, but I could be mistaken, to block Khalil Mack 1-on-1. I thought they fired the offensive coordinator so that this sort of stuff would stop happening.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up. Those are the perils of zone blocking. I thought about that a lot because I forget who it was, but it's Washington. Washington did a lot of zone. They always do a lot of zone running. And a few weeks ago, I noticed that their tight ends were getting matched on defensive ends a lot. Not the Carolina game, but the one before that and the week before that as well. It's one of the things you live with on zone blocking. I wouldn't worry about Detroit's O-line, by the way. I would worry because they're not very good. But as far as the coaching goes, they just hired Ryan Silverfield as assistant O-line coach. And I've gotten to know him very well, and he's probably the best teacher of football that I've spent considerable time with. And that's going up against 30 or 40 other NFL coordinators, top position coaches, a few head coaches.
Yeah, that's high praise.
Yeah, he's a good one. And he was there in Minnesota in 2012, the year Peterson had the 2,000-yard season.
Yeah. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the Eagles. And I was actually having a conversation with a former player of his, a guy who's in the NFL, an off-the-record type deal, and I was wondering, and the insight was pretty good, and I was, you know, thinking, what kind of forum could I share this in? And then I realized that we have a podcast. This player, I asked him, you know, what do you think is the deal in Philadelphia? Why isn't Chip Kelly having the success people thought that he would this season? And his response was, I love Chip. Chip made me into the player that I am, but he's one of the most stubborn people that you will ever meet. And there were things that we all thought made sense for the football team in terms of the play calling, in terms of the roles that guys had, that we all think and we all agree now that we could have had a better football team at Oregon if we did these specific things. But Chip is so stuck in his ways and so stubborn that he asks players to do things that are so far out of their comfort zone that they lose interest or they lose loyalty and dedication. And he ran down the list of a few examples. I mean, this guy's watched a lot of Eagles tape just, you know, for his own enjoyment or whatever. And he ran down a list of examples of guys who are being asked to do things they've never done in their careers and aren't doing them well.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. What stands out with Philadelphia is the personnel changes this year have not panned out the way they'd hoped. And it's Chip Kelly got the power there. DeMarco Murray does not fit what they want to do. Ryan Matthews is a better fit for their scheme, and so is Darren Sproles. So they paid a lot of money to a good running back who doesn't fit. At wide receiver, they have no speed whatsoever, other than, I guess, Josh Huff, who's really more of a quickness guy and not someone you game plan at all against. So no speed at wide receiver. And then the quarterback situation, we've seen Sam Bradford's mediocrity. It's a curious decision making. I think that's the biggest problem this year is the personnel decisions haven't worked out, and that's on Chip Kelly.
Yeah. Let's move on. Panthers at Cowboys. If you wanted any evidence as to how little respect the Panthers have gotten over the course of this 10-0 undefeated run, you got it at the beginning of this week when the line opened up with the Cowboys at 3-7, favored by 1 point over this Carolina Panthers team. I understand it in some ways because you're talking about Tony Romo coming back from injury and the emotional spark that he provides, being at home on Thanksgiving for Dallas. But Carolina has been absolutely dominant in nearly every facet of the game. And last week, you saw some of their wide receivers make enormous contributions outside of Greg Olsen. I mean, you saw Cam Newton spread the field in ways that he hasn't in years past, and perhaps not even at the beginning of the season. I don't think that Carolina's undefeated run stops in Dallas this week.
I wouldn't predict that. Newton has done a lot. You know, actually, both of these quarterbacks, and it's not talked about much with him, although Jenny Ventures wrote a tremendous article about this on Cam Newton's site a few weeks ago. He does a lot at the line of scrimmage before the snap. They have given him a lot of freedom there and a lot of power to change plays. And Romo does as much of that as any quarterback. We saw that against Miami, and it had some plus and minus results. I'll be interested to see how Romo performs because he's coming off a short week after missing a lot of time. And he got demolished by the Dolphins. His offensive line was not good, and that cannot be the case. I don't think you can have Romo get beat up like that two times in 5 days. They need to protect him.
Last game on Thanksgiving before we wrap up the podcast, Bears at Packers. The Bears at 4-6, the Packers at 7-3. One team sliding, another team you could argue surging. The Packers defense has struggled in the last three games prior to their win over the Vikings last week. Do you think they remedied anything there?
I honestly don't mean to get on our researcher John Daigle. I don't know if they've struggled that much in the three games. I know they didn't win the games, but the defense was not the problem. The Denver game, maybe throw that out. They gave up some big plays against Carolina. Those count too, so those are struggles. But they weren't getting exposed. They just got defeated on, I think, 5 or 6 20-plus yard plays. That's stuff you can clean up. That's not a sign of an inherent weakness snap after snap, at least not given that it hasn't happened in other games. And then against Detroit, they were outstanding. So I think Green Bay's defense is very good, top 10 probably, and their versatility and depth makes them probably the hardest in the NFL to game plan against.
Did Green Bay do anything different or better on defense, though, in this game? Because you mentioned the big play. There really weren't any against Minnesota. Is that a function or with Minnesota? Is that a function of some improvement on their end or just the lack of versatility and unpredictability in the Minnesota offense?
That's a great question. That's probably both. For one, let's not forget, Cam Newton's a much better thrower of the football than Teddy Bridgewater, and he can take chances with the ball. Bridgewater needs perfect conditions to fire up and throw the ball downfield. He can't do it under duress like Newton does. So you have more freedom with Newton on big plays. That was one. The second was that the Panthers had a great feel for the Packers' coverage concepts, matchup coverage concepts, and they exploited it with specific route combinations, especially against the zones inside that Green Bay runs. Green Bay went to a little bit more man-to-man stuff against the Vikings, so it was a different schematic approach, and the Vikings took about 2.5 quarters to figure out how to respond to that.
Well, I think that's our show for the week. We've got, we like to close with our non-football recommended reading. Andy, do you got anything this week?
I do. It's in Esquire magazine. It's by Tom, I think it's Junod. It's J-U-N-O-D. It could be Junod. It's probably whatever you want it to be. Tom Junod. It's a piece called 1 Hour. It's about the Charleston, South Carolina shooting, but it's written like it's in fiction form. It's obviously not a fiction thing, but it's got a very unique voice for a reported article. It's one of the most unique pieces I've ever read.
Very good. I got to check that one out. I am rereading one of my favorite books, Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets by David Simon, of course, the creator of The Wire. This was the year in 1987. He spent an entire 365 days in the backseat of patrol cars and in the squad room of the Baltimore Homicide Unit, and wrote a book about that experience that was released a number of years later. I highly recommend it if you're into crime writing or journalism in any way. That's it. Please tweet us at hashtag MMQBpodcast. Thank you to our producer, Daniel Friedman, our researcher extraordinaire, John Daigle. Until next week, I'm Robert Klimko. That's Andy Benoit. Thanks for listening.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.